Hi and welcome. You are listening to The Philosophists, a pair of software guys, but we won't be doing that all our lives. No, one day we'll be paying for those mortgages with the kind of philosopher's salary that would make a top professional soccer player jealous. But today we'll settle for the moral high ground and perhaps injecting a little bit of philosophy into your day.
Back in episode 2, we began our conversation on moving beyond cockroach ethics and how to take action rooted in a firm ethical foundation, rather than just our own survival and self-interest. We looked at two of the three best-known ethical systems, utilitarianism and deontology, and today we're going to talk about the third, virtue ethics.
We'll also touch on a few other subjects before arriving at this destination. Firstly, to get us there, we'll need transport. So Simon has chosen his favourite mode, and that so happens to be a trolley. Not the kind of trolley you'd put the weekly shopping in, rather it's a railway trolley, affixed to a track and hurtling towards danger. All this exciting action will be balanced out by an equal amount of inaction, or is there a difference? We'll find out and try to explore what this means for doing harm versus allowing harm.
We'll also see what the universe thinks of all this as we put in the philosopher Peter Singer's preferred approach to thinking about ethical quandaries. We'll also channel a little Sartre and Jesus, and we'll forgive Declan for almost attributing the golden rule to the wrong one of them.
One person you can't fail to attribute correctly, though, is Kant, who hates to miss out on an ethical party. Once we're done with him, we will indeed move on to virtue ethics, which would arm you with the last of the three mainstream ethical theories. You will then be the life and soul of dinner parties wherever you go, able to excite fellow guests with some of the most interesting philosophical conversation they will have ever heard. Though in our experience, it is more likely that you won't be invited back. My name is Declan McGrath, preferring to go off the rails at times like this.
And my name is Simon Robertson, hoping that this isn't the end of the line for this podcast. As this follows on from the first part of this conversation on cockroach ethics, which was back in episode 2, you may prefer to listen to that episode first. Having said that, this episode can be enjoyed on its own as well. But if you're feeling lost, do consider jumping back into episode 2, as it might fill in some of the gaps.
Okay, the trolley has been set in motion. Let's get philosophistical.
So when I stumbled across this, this was a long time ago now, it was actually in the context of purely to do with action and inaction. I think it's also been used to just demonstrate, in any system you use, I think it's a good test. So, you know, if we're saying, if we come up, for example, with the deontology, kind of the rule-based system, and you say, you know, killing or murder, whatever phrase you want to use, is wrong, then I think the trolley problem is also a very good example. And I would actually be interested in your opinion on a modified trolley problem, which we'll get to in a second. But so the trolley problem, as I understand it, is you're on a tram and it's going along and the line splits and there are five people tied to one track. There's one person tied to the other track and you're currently on course to hit the five. And the question is, should you flick the switch to change tracks to hit the one? And as you say, like, utilitarian argument is you should switch to hit the one because that's the greater good for the greater number. And then my understanding is, like, the deontology, depending on what the rules are, is that you do not flick the switch because you are actively killing that one person. Whereas your inaction is allowing five people to die, but you're not killing them, is the kind of high level argument. Obviously, you can kind of abstract that out a little bit, but yeah, the idea is that the action versus inaction. You know, if the rule is you can't kill people, or you're not killing people if you've not done anything, you're only killing someone if you do flick the switch and it's changed that one track. So, what would your opinion be then for that deontology case? Because you're saying inaction is as accountable, so you would say that the person, even in the rule system of you shouldn't kill, or you know, killing is wrong, you would still say actually they are compelled to actively kill that one person.
Yeah, not yeah as in yes to that, but just yes to the overall example, as in set up nicely. The first thing I think is that the inaction versus action there, I don't really buy that. Now I want to draw a distinction between, I don't know what I necessarily do in that situation personally. So when I talk about what is morally right or wrong here, in my opinion, what I'm going to do is, I think one utilitarian concept, I can't remember exactly who brought it in, but is to take the point of view of the universe, to take a dispassionate view, not from your own perspective and not from the perspective of each of those individuals in the problem, but a utilitarian approach would be, if I could stand back and be this rock and look on and just dispassionately as the rock, not knowing anyone, just go, what is the right thing here? What is the greatest good? You know, it's just occurred to me. I think trolley problems, when they happen, we do see people following a pattern which tends to be, you know, all things being equal, people do pull the lever. I think if someone is a good, maybe an example is this of a real life trolley problem. Someone's driving down the street and they could hit, they know that the car is going out of control. They may hit one person. Okay. But if they're actually, as they drive, heading for a larger crowd of people, they will swerve to avoid them. They will make the calculation that hitting less people is a better outcome than hitting more people. There might be a difference there in that they're not necessarily consciously choosing to hit the one person, but if someone was in a car and that car was, there was two buildings and that car was headed to one building with 100 people in front of it, or another building with 3 people in front of it, I think they'd swerve. I think most people would try to divert away from the 100.
Okay, so I can come up with this, or I say I can come up with, I'm going to steal another example, but I will have to confess, I can't remember the original version of this, or if there is even one, but it's from The Good Place.
Right.
And we are all in a hospital, and we have 5 sick people who all need different organs, and we have one healthy patient that we can chop up and give the healthy organs from to the dying patients, and it'll save all 5. So in this case, would you say your inaction is killing the 5 or not? If I've made that clear in the setup. So the equivalent here is you've got 5 dying people, is who are the people on the track. The healthy person is the one person on the side who would happily live on if you did nothing, but you could harvest their organs and save the other 5.
Yeah. And in that case, I would agree. That's an example where I don't think I'd call it inaction. I think the problem is not necessarily their action versus inaction, but the rights of the person that is going to be sacrificed for the benefit of the other 5. I think it's not so much the action inaction as the violation of something about that person. And I think that's a good thing to return to. We probably need a whole episode to talk about ways of working around that and some hybrid kind of utilitarian ideas that could perhaps do that. But I think that's the problem just for now. I think that's the problem I see is that even for the greater good, if there was indeed greater good, if you could say, look, this is 5 times 1, we're keeping the math simple here. 5 times 1, 5 is better than 1 who loses out. I think most people would say it's not right to do that to the one person. I just don't feel like that's an action inaction thing. I think it's more to do with the fact that there's something which deontology could capture with a rule saying you don't have the right to violate and chop up someone, just no matter who you're going to save. I think deontology can help solve that, like having a rule. But I also think there's a problem that arises out of that. And that's why deontology still isn't the right answer. And I do think we need a form of utilitarianism that can handle that to get at the right answer.
I mean, it's interesting, even just talking about the problem, we start talking about the kind of greater good, which it felt like a very utilitarian way of looking at it. So we're looking at a situation where, you know, you have to break the rule of killing one way or the other, especially if you include inaction as a form of action. And you immediately fell back to a kind of consequential calculation for good. I think it's just very apparent very quickly that is the problem with deontology. Like, I'm not sure if we kind of specify that, but it's like when you have rules, unless you had essentially like a rule per situation, which is obviously impossible, it just very rapidly comes into problems where, you know, if it's wrong to lie and it's wrong to kill, and it's also wrong to steal, and you're in a situation where you have to do one of those three things, then you're stumped. There's, you know, there's nothing you can do. And if inaction causes some kind of problem, you're paralyzed by the fact that you can't take any action on the rules. And then, you know, you might start saying, okay, you rank the rules in some way, but that feels dangerous to start kind of thinking about.
Feels like the laws of robotics kind of territory and Isaac Asimov and, you know, all this iRobot kind of stuff. I think you're right. That is the issue. The issue, like, it kind of brings in philosophy of language. Like, people will say something is ineffable. It's trying to get at the fact that sometimes things we want to describe in maybe the real world or in the moral sphere or in ethics, we can't put it into language. It's simply not possible to write down, you know, precisely describe what we want, because it's just not possible. And I think that happens here, where the problem with deontology is it simply isn't possible to express in rules everything you need to write down. Because with the killing example, you can caveat to, you could caveat to say, well, one should not kill except when maybe someone is in X levels of pain and it's clear that there's no benefit to, you know, them continuing. But again, you've more rules. That's just one of almost infinite number of rules that you'd have to tag onto that. So there must be something. I think that's where deontology falls down. There must be something that we can do that's more abstract than just providing rules, but sticks up for the little guy so that that person doesn't get shafted. I think Jean-Paul Sartre, a French philosopher, it's kind of disputed whether he ever tried to take a shot at this, you know, sort of solving this, but he seemed to come up with that kind of golden rule, you know, idea that's in religious texts, and also that kind of deontological idea that he kind of said, look, if you take an action, you know, you're basically saying that that is what the right thing to do is. So I think one of his things was, well, if you get married, what you are saying is you're saying that everyone should get married. And basically anything that you're saying, that should be taken as an action. If you universalized it, it's the thing of, oh, well, if everybody took that action, would that make a better world? Would that be correct? And I'm not sure if Kant, I can't remember if Kant took that approach as well, but I think something similar, where the quality of a rule is based on the fact that if you universalized it, that would lead to a better overall outcome for everyone. And I can't remember the exact example we're talking about there. I've lost my way.
Well, okay. So if you're talking about, yeah. So when we're trying to figure out like the way you can kind of abstract out the rules to cover like the infinite number of possible scenarios you could come up with, the idea of universalizing your actions to say, if everyone did this, would the world be a better place? I think that's actually very much what Kant was trying to, or at least at one point, I think he described it as a summon bonum or something. So it's like the ideal society, like if everyone acted the way you are acting, would you get closer to an ideal society or something to that effect? It gets very complicated. As a brief summary, I think that's okay. Thing would be, or my argument against that would be something like, when you are making that decision, you are in a very specific circumstance. So if you then say, oh, if everyone in my position made that decision, would it be a better place? But that's a very, very unique situation, which may never, ever come up again. And, you know, it wouldn't be applicable. And you could say you had the example of marriage you brought up. You know, if you get married, you're saying marriage is a good thing. But I mean, when I, you know, choose to get married, I might be very conscious of like my financial position. I might be conscious of some religious prejudice from external society, for example. And so I might make a decision because like for that very specific situation, it's like, oh yeah, that was actually the right decision to make. And I love my wife and all those kind of things. But, but you know, it might make sense for that decision. But if, for example, I wasn't financially secure and I didn't have other pressures in that situation, then it wouldn't be the right decision, I would argue. So I think saying like, oh, I am affirming that marriage is good is too broader situation. And I think you would just come back down to the same problem of saying, okay, great, could I universalize this rule? And you know, you could trivially say yes, but the next time that situation came up, it's like all you need is one tiny difference to come out with a different outcome. And then you suddenly say, well, you know, this isn't a thing to do, this isn't the same situation, so I can't reuse my rule. So I don't know, I do like it, and from like a philosophical point of view and like a logical point of view, it feels really good. It feels really satisfying, but I just think that it's like it gets too bogged down in detail too quickly to kind of make universal rules. That's my opinion, anyway.
So, Immanuel Kant, failing grade. Jean-Paul Sartre, failing grade. Step aside. To close the loop on the golden rule, because I mentioned that, but I didn't really define it. That is the, you should treat others the way you want to be treated, I believe. Am I right on that? Something like
that? Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's been around. That is the golden rule. Yeah, but I think it's been around for a lot longer than Sartre.
I think so, yeah. Failing grade, yeah. Jesus. So we've covered everyone. So just to recap where we're at. So we've hit utilitarianism at the start, this calculus stuff, the greater good, and detailed the problems of that. We then went on to the rules, deontology. That was kind of second move in the game. Deontology, a rule-based system to try and stick up for the little guy. And then the third thing we'll probably come on to now, which, you know, if we mention Jesus, it's as good a time as any to bring it in, is virtue ethics. And that might be, well, I don't know if you want to crack at defining that first. This is the one I'm least comfortable defining, but I think if we get stuck, I can give it a go.
Well, I think, yeah. I mean, with any of these things, I'm very hesitant, but I like to try and take like the simplest version of it I'm aware of to at least start with. And it's, to me, it's essentially saying, what would a good person do? That's how you decide what is good. So that sounds kind of circular, and I can understand why you might think that, but you can start looking at what a good person is, and you would start arguing about or coming up with like virtues. So if people are, you could say rationality, being rational is a virtue. You could say being passionate is a virtue, being honest, being brave, being courageous, whatever you'd want to classify as virtuous. If you say people who have these virtues are good people, and what would a good person do? That's my very quick attempt at it. And it kind of feels that there is some merit to that. You do, I think there are some people when you encounter in the world, you think they are good people. And you know, there's many times when people will say, oh, what would X do? What would, you know, you try and emulate someone. And it, I don't know, it feels like it's a useful way of at least thinking about it. I don't know. I mean, like, what do you think? Are you a fan of virtue ethics or?
So I think you summed up well there. I think it is the right place to start, that good person, you know, being good. And it is kind of that simple at the start. I think the qualifying thing, and I think you said it already, is it's the ethical systems we've talked about up until now have talked about the actions, or at least the actions that led to an outcome. So in utilitarianism, we were still saying, what is the right thing to do here? You know, what is the action? In deontology, however, you know, in rule-based systems, however we were getting there, we were saying, well, what is the right thing to do? I think virtue is different in that it's about the person more than the action, and about the character of the person more than the rightness or wrongness of what you're about to do. And the intention, the idea is that given a good enough person, well, it's a given that the actions that will flow from that person are virtuous. So in terms of training someone to be ethical, you would, and this, I think this happened a lot back in, it dates back to kind of times of Plato and Aristotle and Socrates. Three of them in the wrong order there, just worth pointing out. Socrates first. But going all the way back, a lot of the training back then talked about virtues. You know, there was a lot of talk of virtue ethics. That's kind of the ethical system they had back then, really. And it does go back to, how could I raise my, you know, children to be people of good character with these virtues? So I think that then we get into the kind of virtues of, well, what are the different virtues? There's ones like bravery. There's ones like, I suppose there's things like just respectfulness. You know, there's things like, you know, other virtues like strength. There are many virtues, but what are the parts of someone's character? Empathy is another kind of virtue. You know, what are the kind of aspects of someone's character that can make them a good person? Just, you know, what I'd say is I think there's something to be said for it, because in this day and age, a lot of, you know, the way people are inspired or are influenced to do anything is often by looking at, let's call, kind of cult-ish leaders. So we've seen that in politics. We see that in the deifying of maybe Elon Musk's tweets. You know, people, for whatever reason, there's a bug in our software. It's also partially a feature that we look up to people, and maybe the virtues that are in, you know, the people that are deified at the moment, maybe the virtues aren't necessarily the best virtues, but they have the virtue of being loud and attention getting. That would be the virtue they have. I think that's kind of where it is. I think it's important because it breeds some sort of life into everything we've talked about so far. Is a bit dead, isn't it? It's a bit, you know, clinical. And when you start talking about virtues, it's easy to get on board with, like, honesty, you know, courage, bravery, compassion. It's easy to get on board with that, I think. That's where I think the benefit is. I don't know if you utterly disagree with that, but...
No, I agree. This is the thing I would come back to at the start. We talked about at the start is that kind of instinct feeling, a bit of like you have this feeling of what's right, oftentimes, and you know you would look to good people to see what they would do, and you know you do come to the problem of like how you define a good person. I understand that, and like we've talked about the virtues, that's not a perfect system. There's problems with that, but it definitely does seem to be a thing of, you know, if you take it purely abstract, there, what would a good person do? I think that kind of gets around a lot of the problems of, you know, in tough decisions. So, I'd be breaking this rule, or I'd have to do this calculation. So, you know, what would a good person do? Just feels like a very something you could connect to in the real world, kind of easily, almost. Like I think philosophically, like it has problems, but like I said, like I think it's interesting. Like as you go through this kind of the kind of arc we've talked through here, where it's like, yeah, but you need to have some applicability to the real world. That kind of idea of like what would a good person do, and those kind of, you know, being virtuous, it's very appealing, especially when you've seen the other problems we've come across.
And
I'm just gonna leave it there because it feels like quite nice to end on a good note and just leave virtue ethics alone.
No, I don't have the virtue of being sympathetic to any philosophical house. I think I definitely see lots of benefits for people these days to it. I suppose we should call out that how on earth can you get at the right answer from virtue ethics in a logical sense? I mean, you can have competing virtues, like let's say the classic thing is, well, a bank robber could be very brave. Like it does take bravery to go in and rob a bank. I mean, I wouldn't do it. And part of that is just I won't be able to go and do it.
But I mean, okay, but I think even before you get to that point, you've got the problem of saying, like, what are the virtues? Like, that's difficult enough to start with. So if you say, like, honesty is a virtue, it's like, okay. I mean, like, that seems intuitively correct. And you start talking about bravery and things, it's like, okay. But then you start talking about, like, courage. Like, is courage a virtue? In the fact that, like, well, if I was too courageous, like, what would that mean? Like, would I be, I don't know, starting fights? I don't know, just to prove a point kind of thing. I can't think of, that's like a great example, but like, it just feels that, like, you know, lying can be virtuous in the sense, like, you can tell white lies. You wouldn't say lying's a virtue, but a good person could lie. So it's like, does that mean that, like, honesty is also a vice if you were not being honest? If honesty was a bad thing to do in that case? And depending on how you define them, it feels like it'd be very like cultural based very quickly. Like, I imagine like back in Roman times when they like, you know, admired gladiators, you know, some sort of ruthlessness would be a virtue. I feel that ruthlessness now is less of a virtue. And that's hard to kind of say, how do you pick your virtues? I think that's a tough one to figure out.
Yeah. No, I'd agree that sums up the problem quite neatly. It gives the ethics you're doing, it would be described as relativistic. In other words, it's all just relative to, there's no real objective standard of what is right and wrong. It's very hard to say from the point of view of the universe, like we said earlier on, dispassionately, what looks right looking out at all these situations unfolding. So I think in that case, virtue probably seems like the loosest and hardest one to get a good answer out of there. But I don't think you definitely can't really throw it away, because it is something, even if its job was to help market the right answer that we may get from utilitarianism and deontology or other systems. Definitely virtue ethics does seem to have a massive role there in terms of influencing people. So I think we're definitely coming up on some sort of time. One interesting thing I thought of was just with Kant. I was kind of wondering, I suppose the answer is no, but I did wonder, is he really a virtue ethics in disguise? And that he's a virtue ethicist. The only thing is, he only really focuses on the virtue of respect. So if we go back to unpack that, like if we go back to the point where we say, well, a person, you should treat people as an end. I also have to think of that in themselves, not a means to get what you want or whatever. is Kant just going with the virtue of respect? And most of his ethics spills out from that, whether it be very logical, very rational, however he justifies it, very universal. But really, I get the feeling that he's scoping and zoning everything in the virtue of respect more than anything else. And everything else follows from that.
I think you're going to have a mechanism one way or the other to figure out what you're going to be using if you're trying to use rationality to define your rules for what's good. I think, for example, you could also make a case that he's some kind of consequentialist, because he's saying the universalization of your decisions, what are the consequences of that? That would be the good thing. But I think the key difference when it comes to Kant is the reason why you're doing the thing. So you're not doing the thing because you are a good person and that's what good people do. You're doing that thing because it is the right thing to do. Like, you're doing it because it's like you've done the maths, or however you want to describe it. It's like you've come to the conclusion that this is the rule that is right, and you're doing it because it's the rule, not because that's what a good person would do. I think that's the key difference. So like the action might have like parallels, but I think that's the key difference. Is you're saying, you know, it's the reason I'm doing it is because it's the rule.
Yeah.
That it's the right thing to do.
Not what you get out of it.
It just so happens you've come to the same conclusion as you would by looking at the virtues. That'd be my kind of take on it. It's the reason why you're doing it, not the way you get to what to do.
Yeah, and I think that neatly closes things out. I suppose one virtue is that of not outstaying one's welcome. So maybe we'll leave things there for now. I can sense a few people starting to nod off. So there will be an epilogue to follow all this up, but it will likely be done as a separate episode in its own right, which makes it sound more like an epic log. Anyway, bad puns aside, thank you for listening, and a special thanks to those of you that have subscribed to the podcast. If you haven't already done so, then know that subscribing is one of the easiest ways to boost the virtue of your character. There are absolutely no downsides. And finally, a reminder to check out the show notes for this episode. There are many links in there that explain the topics we've discussed today far better than we ever could. You might feel rightly aggrieved that we didn't just tell you that up front. But rather than getting angry, you're probably much better off staying philosophistical. Until next time.